The essence of this book, Farewell Dear People, stems from the way Australians have thought about the devastating impact of World War I. At the start of the war in 1914, our national population was less than 5 million. The effect of 60,000 dead and all the maimed was catastrophic, obviously. But it is hardly surprising then that evaluation of the consequences of World War I for Australia over the ensuing decades has tended to focus on the collective impact of all those casualties. And this is, after all, appropriately democratic and consistent with our egalitarian traditions. That there must have been exceptionally talented individuals among the 60,000 dead has been implicitly understood. But do we know today who they were? No, we don't. Do we know their stories? What made them special? No, we don't. If you asked informed readers in England about Britain's lost generation of World War I, a significant proportion would say, yes, you mean Rupert Brooke and Raymond Asquith and so on. But do we know our equivalents here, our Rupert Brookes? No, we don't. No, we don't. I don't normally drift into Obama speak. It just seemed a good way to make the point on such a significant 24 hours for him. The aim of the book is to remedy this substantial deficiency in the national story. The book covers 10 Australians of rare potential who died during the war. They had outstanding pre-war achievements or outstanding character, or both. And for most of them, it was both. Nearly all of them was both. They came from a variety of backgrounds, geographically as well as socially, some affluent and some decidedly not, and they distinguished themselves in a range of spheres. For each of these remarkable Australians, I've written an extended biography so that the reader will know them well, will appreciate why they were special, and will understand why their premature deaths were a profound loss for Australia, as well as for their families and communities. This is Geoff McRae, a budding architect who was a product of Melbourne's best-known creative dynasty. He combined his family's flair for writing and drawing with an endearing personality and a strong sense of right and wrong. He hated war, and he yearned to be home with his family and his girlfriend. But as long as this ghastly war continued, he felt that his duty was to play his part in it. And his was no small part. He was a battalion commander at an unusually young age. Women adored him. Sometimes when that image goes up, I get the response, yeah, movie star looks. Yeah. Attractive women were attracted to Geoff, but he only had eyes for one by August 1914. Her name was Maud Richards of Camberwell. And during the war, he missed her terribly. He wrote about her with the most poignant longing. Take, for example, this sentence he just dashed off in his diary. I feel very weary, but do not sleep, and long for the touch of a vanished hand. Ah. The title of the book, Farewell Dear People, comes from the remarkable final letter that McRae wrote home to his family on 19th July 1916. The Battle of Fromelles, which began later that day, remains the worst 24 hours in Australia's entire history. 5,533 Australian casualties in one night. Now, what McRae wrote in the quick letter he dashed off to his family that day was this. Today I lead my battalion in an assault on the German lines, and I pray to God I may come through all right and bring honour to our name. If not, I will at least have laid down my life for you and my country, which is the greatest privilege one can ask for. Farewell, dear people. The hour approacheth. And that's the whole letter. Geoff was the youngest of six in his family. His father, George, was a noted poet who also wrote prose and liked sketching. Geoff and George were particularly close. Jeff's older brother, Hugh, a well-known poet, artist and cartoonist who moved to Sydney while Jeff was still young and didn't see much of Jeff afterwards, carried with him for years an image of tall George and small Jeff, happily together with their fingers intertwined. This is a photo of Jeff just after he'd been wounded in the early fighting at Gallipoli. Now, Jeff's father, George, was 83 when Jeff died in 1916. George's full life of personal and intellectual fulfilment contrasted with the abbreviated span of his youngest son. But in 1916, George still had another decade and more of alert life ahead of him. He devoted much of it to commemorating Jeff. This obsessive devotion reflected the intensity of the father's never-ending grief. It was as if he could in some way maintain the connection of those intertwined fingers by turning Jeff's bedroom into a perpetual shrine, by cherishing his medals and mementos, by installing a memorial window, by compiling commemorative verse, by seeking his personal effects, by sketching his faraway grave, by locating the cemetery site, by pursuing posthumous awards, and by spending hours and hours transcribing Jeff's wartime diary and letters, even re-sketching the accompanying drawings. This is an internationally acclaimed medical researcher named Clunes Matheson. Anyone heard of him? He was a marvel. The Florey or Macfarlane Burnett or Gus Noswell that Australia missed out on because he was fatally wounded in the first weeks of Gallipoli while serving as a battalion doctor. Matheson was born and educated in Victoria, and he received the most glowing accolades from medical scientists of the highest international renown. The director of the Lister Institute in London remarked that no man I have ever known possesses the genius for research so highly as Matheson. Another esteemed British professor wrote after Matheson's death that for the science of medicine throughout the world, the loss is irreparable. For the science of medicine throughout the world, the loss is irreparable. And the London Times History of the War lamented Matheson's death as the loss of a life which had been judged infinitely precious. Matheson was a revered personality as well as a renowned researcher. Someone who knew him well put it this way: of Dr. Matheson as a scientist, let others speak. I speak of him as a friend, and as a friend, he was wonderful. He never flagged. The variety of his interests was remarkable. I've been with him on all sorts of occasions: yarning, cricketing, camping, canoeing, fishing, ski running, and it was always the same. Whether it was a question of scientific knowledge, or of academic diplomacy, or the value of a book, or a picture, or a piece of music, or the fastening of a ski binding, it was always, "Ask Matthew." His cheery, chubby figure was welcome everywhere. He knew every professor and every policeman in London and was equally at home hobnobbing with either. Here are a couple of photos of him at Caulfield Grammar. In each one, he's the little bloke sitting at the front on the right. Same again. Little bloke sitting at the front on the right. Now, there's not much of him in that footy team photo, is there? So it must have been after he left school that he became a bit chubby. Matheson's parents were both school teachers and widely admired. They had six children, but Clunes was the only one to reach the age of 10. As well, his father died painfully at home of illness when Clunes was 12. He clearly experienced a great deal of death and suffering in his family during his childhood. Considering that he had such wide-ranging interests across the humanities as well as the sciences, the conclusion seems inescapable that the sickness and sadness around him as he grew up influenced his decision to pursue a career as a researcher in medical science. Essentially, what he felt driven to do was to make scientific discoveries that would help sick people get better. Australia was deprived of this unique, precious genius in a deplorable way. He died while the 2nd Australian Brigade was temporarily transferred from the Anzac Cove landing site and inland from there down to Helles, where they came under the command of a singularly inept British commander, General Hunter Weston. What Hunter Weston directed these Victorians to do on the 8th of May 1915 was to charge towards Krithia for 3 miles along an exposed spur in broad daylight against the same Turkish machine gunners and riflemen who had halted a series of similar attacks before any of them had progressed 1/6 of that distance. So you can have a go at it. If you don't get it right, you can just keep doing it till you do. That was Hunter Weston's methodology. The Victorians charged with the utmost gallantry. Onlookers likened it to the legendary charge of the Light Brigade, but casualties were inevitably severe. Matheson tended the many wounded with exceptional bravery and selflessness. Matthew made it known that, "Wherever I am wanted, just tell me and I will try to go." The historian of Matheson's unit recorded that when it became known that a Turkish bullet had found Matheson, the news depressed the whole battalion. In 1953, almost 40 years after Matheson's death, McFarlane Burnett described him as an Australian equivalent of Rupert Brooke. This is a photo of Robert Beige, an engineer who was a senior colleague of Mawson's and performed outstandingly at Antarctica, but he's another who's long forgotten. Mawson's expeditioners happened to base themselves at the windiest place on the planet. The windiest place on the whole planet. Here are some of them in their hut, with Beige on the far left looking on, as Frank Hurley, the famous photographer, trims John Hunter's beard. Now, John Hunter was a scientist from Sydney who did not know Beige before their time together at Antarctica. He quickly developed a very high regard for Beige. And what Hunter wrote about Beige in his diary was this: "Bob Beige is the best liked man on the expedition, and personally I think he's the best man we have. He is an untiring worker, stopping up all hours of the night, even to early in the morning. He is ever ready to help anybody. Personally, he is a fine fellow and of jovial spirit and smiling countenance. There is no one that I have met that I have greater respect for than Bob. In fact, he is an ideal fellow, and I hope our friendship will long continue." Unquote. So that's quite an accolade from the chap that Beige had not long known. After the expeditioners had endured months of ferocious blizzards cooped up in their hut, Mawson placed Beige in charge of a daunting sledging expedition. There were multiple sledging expeditions that went out east and west along the coast from where their hut was. Beige was the only one that went down south. It was a daunting sledging expedition. Beige and his two colleagues, and Frank Hurley was one, ventured more than 300 miles south across rough terrain where no one had been before, despite encountering the most violent hurricanes. In this photo, Beige is on the right, reading their sledge meter to check how far they'd come. He and his comrades were then 278 miles south of their hut. Along the way, they made regular geographical, meteorological and magnetic measurements because they were exploring for scientific research. They were, in fact, not far from the South Pole, but this was not a superficial exercise of getting to some target just for the shallow glory of being the first to plonk a flag there. It was an exceedingly dangerous expedition, and Beige and his comrades only just managed to survive their harrowing return journey. But their remarkable feat was little known at the time, and it's completely unknown now. All the sledging expeditions returned to the hut that was the home base of Mawson's men within a couple of days of Mawson's deadline, except one. That was the three-man party led by Mawson himself. The ship that was to take all the expeditioners back to Australia, the Aurora, had arrived with its irascible captain, J.K. Davis. He was known as Gloomy Davis. But his concern about delay was understandable, as ships had limited seasonal scope to manoeuvre in these icy waters. Several days later, with Davis increasingly tense and still no sign of Mawson, six expeditioners, including Beige, were selected to stay on for another winter in case Mawson's party belatedly turned up. And naturally, they were among the more reliable, dependable ones. Eventually, Davis decided he couldn't wait any more, and the Aurora departed, only for Mawson to materialise later that very day, in an emaciated state, with the harrowing news that the two comrades with him had died. And as if this wasn't dramatic enough, when they managed to send a wireless message to the Aurora asking for it to return, which it did, with great reluctance from Gloomy Davis, the sea was too wild for Mawson, Beige and the others to be collected. They were waiting on the shore, knowing that Davis would be increasingly agitated about this further delay. In the end, he decided he could linger no longer, and the Aurora departed again. So, the hopes of Beige and his shore-based companions were shattered. They had to endure another year of isolation and limited amenities and apocalyptic weather before they could be collected. And a sinister surprise further drained morale when one of them went mad. Beige became wary of even conversing in the hut, as this troubled colleague would bizarrely misinterpret even the most innocuous remarks. When the Aurora reappeared on 13 December 1913, the jubilation ashore was understandably intense. Beige and his companions really were going home this time. Their arrival in Australia was a celebrated event. Beige, to his surprise, found himself in demand as a speaker. This is a photo of Beige, a remarkable photo of Beige, striking photo, on his way home after more than 2 years of outstanding service to Australia at Antarctica. Only a year later, though, he was killed in the first fortnight at Gallipoli. Now, what happened was this. Beige was the deputy leader of one of the original companies of engineers. He landed with his company on the original Anzac Dome, and during the chaos of the first few days ashore, Beige and his men did the kind of things that engineers did. They widened roads, strengthened trenches, constructed loopholes, excavated emplacements for the artillery and so on, that kind of thing. Beige spent the morning of 7th May surveying. The young men with him paused for a bit of lunch. And Beige strolled around to the adjacent AIF position, perhaps intent on getting something to eat there himself. Now, as it happened, the commander of the AIF's 1st Division, Major General Bridges, was there. Bridges had been appraising the tactical options in the local area, and he had just come to a decision about what he wanted. When Beige materialised along the trench, Bridges suddenly said, "Oh, here's the man!" Now, Beige was startled. He wasn't used to being addressed in such fashion by a Major General. But then he found out why he was the man, and he became seriously perturbed. Bridges had decided that he wanted the infantry in the local area to occupy a forward post, and he wanted a reliable engineer, which of course exactly described Beige, and it was why he had said, "Here's the man," a reliable engineer to mark out the position beforehand so that the infantry would know exactly where Bridges wanted them to dig in. This would involve Beige venturing out 150 yards in front of the then Anzac position and banging in some marker pegs in view of the Turks, and Bridges wanted this done straight away. Beige respectfully pointed out that this would be a very risky undertaking and the best chance of carrying it out effectively would be to do it at night. But Bridges was adamant. He wanted it done that afternoon. That is, in broad daylight and in full view of the Turks. Now, Bage was a loyal officer. He knew that an order was an order. Now, Bage was also a highly capable and insightful officer. He was well aware that his prospects of surviving such a venture were slim. He resigned himself to his probable fate and arranged for the dispersal of his belongings. Bage did his utmost to carry out the task. He was hammering in a marker peg where Bridges wanted when he was killed by a fusillade of fire from umpteen Turkish riflemen and at least five machine guns. Australians have tended to be critical of incompetent British generals whose ineptitude led to the deaths of regrettably many Australians. Understandably critical in the case of commanders like General Haking, who acquired the sobriquet Haking the Butcher. He was culpable for the death of Jeff McRae and thousands of others at Fromelles in the worst 24 hours in Australian history. And also General Hunter Weston, who was culpable, as I've said, for the similarly atrocious decision to throw the 2nd Australian Brigade at preposterously short notice into the notorious charge towards Krithia, the action which led to the death of the irreplaceable Clunes Matheson. But what happened to Bob Bage at Gallipoli on 7th May 1915, when his life was cavalierly imperilled by General Bridges, and he predictably died, underlines that inept decisions by generals that led to the deaths of Australians with the most outstanding potential for future greatness were made by Australian commanders as well as by British ones. This photo depicts an exceptionally talented soldier from a working class background in Sydney named Tom Elliott. He was part of the second intake at Duntroon, which entered the college in 1912 after a series of competitive exams. There were more than 100 applicants from around Australia, and Tom ended up with the highest marks. Here he is on the left in a close finish at an athletics meeting at Duntroon, and his best mate is alongside him fighting at the finish, and the best mate was Bluey Thorn. This is the Duntroon rugby team, with Tom third from right in the back row. This Duntroon side was unbeaten for years, and some experts felt that there was no finer team in Australia, apart from a national side. Five of these players, one third of the team, died in World War I, and of the 10 who survived, at least half became major generals or even better. So clearly the probability was that the five who died, among those five, there was some serious talent as well. And in Tom Elliott's case, that was definitely so. In 1916, Tom was an officer in the 60th Battalion, which was part of Pompey Elliott's 15th Brigade. Pompey knew Tom for only 4 months, but in that time formed the view that Tom was the finest natural soldier he had ever met and an officer of immense potential who'd be crucial to Australia's future. When Pompey concluded, correctly, that the proposed attack at Fromelles would prove a disaster, he tried to persuade his superiors to cancel it. And when this attempt did not succeed, he tried to keep Tom out of the battle because he was so precious to Australia's future. Pompey told a number of people that Tom, in Pompey's view, was poised to become potentially an Australian Kitchener, which in the context of, Kitcheners are regarded very differently now by some assessors and critics, but in the context of 1916, that is an extraordinary accolade. The context of Kitchener's prestige in 1916. So Pompey could hardly have praised Tom more highly. tried to keep Tom out of the battle because he was so precious to Australia's future. But Tom ended up participating at Fromelles and he was killed. A big focus of the book is the dual impact of the loss of these special Australians I've written about, that they were a big loss to Australia as well as to their families. And this is certainly the case with Tom Elliott. And the upshot within his family was catastrophic. His mother, Mary, could not accept Tom's death. The mixed messages that she received were influential. First, she was told that he'd been wounded, then that he was missing, and later that he was killed. She kept pressing the authorities for clarification. "It is an awful thing to leave a mother in doubt. The suspense is dreadful," she told them. She resorted to alcohol to help her cope and then began to have delusions about Tom. Eventually, she was placed in an asylum for the insane, and she died there of Spanish flu in mid-1919. Three of Tom's younger brothers enlisted, one at the age of 15. All of these three soldiers were wounded, and one of them died, also in 1919, but thankfully after Mary's death, so she wasn't aware of that. Now, there's another biography in the book of someone from a Sydney working class background with a rugby connection who's long forgotten and pretty much unknown today. His name is Edward Larkin, and here he is on the far left in this photo of the Australian rugby team in 1903. Later, he became the key figure in the rise to prominence of the breakaway code of rugby league, which became the leading winter sport in Sydney and beyond while Larkin was running it. In 1913, Ted Larkin pulled off an upset at the New South Wales state election by winning the seat of Willoughby as the Labor candidate. That's Willoughby on the North Shore, not seen as likely Labor territory. And Larkin proceeded to make a highly impressive start in Parliament. Certainly a lot more impressive than another Labor newcomer who entered the New South Wales Parliament after the 1913 New South Wales state election, a little known estate agent named... Any takers?
Hooker?
No, not Hooker. No. Little known estate agent entering the New South Wales Parliament at the 1913 state election. Later became a lot more known. Someone said Lang is correct. Lang is correct. Before long, political pundits were predicting a big future for Larkin. They weren't saying that about Lang at that stage, but they were about Larkin just after he entered Parliament. And some were even seeing him already as a future Premier. But then the Great War began. Now, Larkin, who's on the left here, enlisted in the first rush, and he died in the first rush on the original Anzac Day. He left a grieving widow and two little boys. Now, Larkin, the thing about Larkin was that he was particularly devoted to his family and not particularly devoted to the military. He had attained prominence and success through determination and toil, and bigger and better things were not far away. But all this Larkin relinquished reluctantly, with no illusions, because he conceived it as his duty, by virtue of his prominence, initially as a sportsman and more latterly as a politician, to set an example for footballers and other sportsmen to follow. So Larkin nobly enlisted primarily to inspire others to do so. Larkin is commemorated in a plaque on the wall of the New South Wales Legislative Assembly, and it was unveiled at this moving ceremony in November 1915. Now, having covered a couple of Sydney-siders with rugby connections, it's time to switch to Australian rules. You knew that, madam, didn't you? Came just in time. This is George Challis, a brilliant Aussie rules footballer who was recruited from Tasmania by Carlton. Challis played four splendid seasons with the Blues before he went away to war and became another very special Australian to be killed at Cremorne. My biography of Challis covers his upbringing and education at the tiny Tasmanian hamlet of Cleveland, just south of Launceston, and then Launceston itself, how he came to be recruited by Carlton, how he became a revered star for the Blues, how the way the game was played at that time differed from today, how the fierce rivalries between Carlton and Collingwood and between Carlton and Essendon, which is so alive and well today, were initiated in the era just before World War I, and how Challis's death was lamented by Tasmanians and Carltonians for decades afterwards. Challis is on the right here with his close friend and teammate at both Launceston and Carlton, Viv Valentine. Now, Challis's most dazzling performance in his first VFL season, 1912, was against Carlton's bitter rivals from Essendon. The big crowd that day was captivated by his pace and grace. It was said that the typical Carlton supporter of that era was described as barracking with a voice like that of a man who has swallowed the claw of his crayfish in the Boozer's Express at midnight. Some would say not much has changed. But the Carlton fans were ecstatic on that memorable day when a reporter wrote this about Challis. He played like a champion against Essendon, pulled himself out of tight corners, swung the ball into position, measuring his kicks almost to the inch. He was superb. And if there was a cup for the best player on the ground, Challis would have won the Challis. Almost to the inch. Almost to the inch. Now, there's the confirmation for those of us who enjoy Dennis Committee's AFL commentary that 100 years ago they were talking about the pre-metric equivalent of centimetre perfect. This is Carew Rennell, a South Australian winemaker. I was keen to have a spread of backgrounds in the 10 biographies. Challis was from Tasmania. Tom Elliott spent his important Duntroon years in Canberra. Larkin, like Tom Elliott, was from Sydney. Beige, Matheson and McRae were Victorians. I'll be talking about Western Australians in a minute. And Carew Rennell was from South Australia. Carew began managing his family's winery at Rennella when he was only about 19 and used the latest scientific techniques to good effect. Carew was a visionary vigneron and a highly successful one. He was a widely admired community leader as well. Carew was renowned as a horse rider of exceptional dash and fearlessness. He became commander of a light horse regiment in the AIF and was killed leading it into action at Gallipoli. He left a widow and a little boy and girl. Here he is at Rennella with his children just before he went away to war. And the little bloke on the left, as you look at it, he became an outstanding pilot and he was killed in the Battle of Britain in 1940. Now, for almost all of you, or perhaps all of you, unless you've read the book, the names and the stories in Farewell Dear People won't be familiar. However, this bloke is one of the 10, and I'm sure that everyone here knows something about him. I don't think you'll know who he is, unless you've read what I've written about him, but you do know something about him, even though you don't know that you know it. To explain, I need to take you back to the 1970s, when there was a talented Australian who yearned to create a special gripping story about Gallipoli. He'd been grappling with this project for years. He had read Charles Bean's official history. He had visited Anzac Cove. He had traversed the trenches. He had tossed around plenty of ideas, various angles, numerous drafts, but none had proved ultimately satisfying. None was compelling enough for what he was trying to do. And then, one day, he happened to read Charles Bean's official history again, and in particular, a sentence about someone who was last seen running forward like a schoolboy in a foot race with all the speed he could compass. The potential of that sentence jumped out at him. It suddenly occurred to him that here was the way to shape his story. Now, the name of the talented Australian who had an exhilarating breakthrough when he read that sentence is, as some of you may have realised, is Peter Weir, who went on to make his celebrated film Gallipoli. Peter Weir's name is well known, but the man he had read about, the light horseman who was last seen running forward like a schoolboy in a foot race, is hardly known at all. That's him there. Now, his name is Wilfred Harper. Wilfred Harper's story has never been told until this book. A small number of experts are aware that the Bean sentence about Wilfred was the inspiration for Peter Weir's film, but few even of them know anything about Wilfred other than that sentence about how he died. And I should emphasise here that the character in the film, Archie Hamilton, remember that name? Archie Hamilton, is not Wilfred. Gallipoli is a feature film. It's not a documentary. Now, it is true that Wilfred and Archie were both from Western Australia, both had a farming background, both were in the 10th Light Horse, and both died in the charge of the neck and in the same way. However, there were important differences. Archie is younger than Wilfred. Also, Archie was a reinforcement who arrived at Gallipoli just before the August offensive, as you remember, whereas Wilfred was a 10th Light Horse original who'd been at Gallipoli since May. As well, Archie, as I'm sure you remember, was a top-class sprinter, whereas Wilfred's interests and talents lay more in cricket and football than in athletics. Here's Wilfred in the 1908 photo of his school cricket team. Wilfred is in the centre of the middle row as captain, best batsman and best bowler. So, Archie in the Gallipoli film is not Wilfred Harper, although the manner of Wilfred's death was indeed the inspiration for the film. Wilfred had a notable brother in the 10th Light Horse, Gresley Harper. He was also killed in the charge of the neck. Now, Gres Harper, a barrister with a vivid personality, had a brilliant career ahead of him in the law and or politics, and nothing remotely approaching a biography has been written about him either. Gres was amiable and convivial. He had heaps of friends and amused them with his quick wit and rapier repartee. Now, it's of course not possible to reel off a series of examples in a talk like this while I'm trying to say a bit about each of the ten, but one brief sentence can perhaps give you a flavour. When Gresley's troopship, on its way to Egypt, stopped briefly at Colombo, and Gres knew that mention of this in letters home was banned under the censorship that officers enforced by checking the men's letters, he referred to it in his next letter to his mother in this way. "Where we landed is, of course, a profound secret which you are not considered a fit person to hold." Gres was instrumental in one of the most remarkable incidents of the whole Gallipoli campaign. It happened in May, when he was among a party of light horsemen who were directed to capture a crater from the Turks at Quinn's Post. Quinn's Post, as you'll know, key position among the Anzac sector. The light horsemen charged the crater and succeeded in capturing it, with the Turks who'd been occupying it either killed or driven out of it, with one exception: a Turk who was wounded in the skirmish and couldn't get away. But Grez and his comrades soon realised that they themselves were trapped. The enemy front line was nearby, and the Turks kept shooting at the crater and lobbing bombs into it. The Australians had no bombs, and the Turks had plenty. Moreover, it was an oppressively hot day, and the light horsemen had limited water. They had a tense, gruelling ordeal for hours, perpetually on edge and on alert in case a bomb landed in the crater and they had to throw it back before it exploded. Those with cricket experience, who included Grez, proved very handy at this. Even in these dire circumstances, Grez Harper's humanitarian instincts prevailed. He befriended the wounded Turk who was stuck in the crater with them. Grez fixed up his wound for him and gave him some of the Anzac rations. The upshot was a startling development. Eventually, a group of Turks charged the crater to regain it, and the Australian light horsemen, including Grez, had to scramble back to their front line. But when one of them slipped and fell back into the crater, three bold Turks rushed forward and captured him. The wounded Turk, who was Grez Harper's friend, a bystander up to this point, then made an astonishing intervention. He picked up a discarded rifle, shot two of these Turkish captors, his own countrymen, and grappled with the third, enabling the vulnerable Australian to escape, and ensuring his own death, of course, as other Turks saw what had happened. Pretty soon, the astounding story of the Turk who swapped sides swept through the AIF and reached even the inner circle of King George in England. In this photo of the Harper brothers and their father, Grez is seated on the left, and Wilfred, being the youngest, is reclining in front. This photo of Grez and Wilf in Egypt with the two comrades of their light horse section was taken exactly a week before the Gallipoli landing. I came to the Harpers relatively late in the piece when it occurred to me that a book like this on Australia's lost generation should contain coverage of the Western Australians at the neck. I then discovered that there was another member of the 10th Light Horse who had exceptional promise, Phipps Turnbull, who was also killed in the charge at the neck. This is the 10th and final chap I'm talking about, so we're on the last page. You've been very patient, nearly there. Now, Phipps Turnbull. After a brilliant scholastic and sporting career, Phipps was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship and became the fourth Rhodes Scholar from WA. He proceeded to Oxford University and emerged with an outstanding degree. In his year, 60 candidates attained final honours in jurisprudence, but only three of them were awarded first-class honours. Turnbull was among the three, an exceptional accomplishment. Phipps combined widely admired character and personality with academic attainments of the highest distinction. A shining future for Phipps Turnbull in the law and or politics was a certainty. Here he is with his fiancée, Molly Marmion. I found that the Harper brothers and Phipps Turnbull knew each other and had quite a bit in common, so I decided to combine the stories of the three of them into a single chapter, which covers not only these three interwoven biographies, but also a collective account of how the charge at the neck devastated Western Australia. In conclusion, some general remarks, very briefly. During the years I was researching and writing this book, I was asked, as historians and indeed all writers often are, what project are you working on? And when I explained what this book was about, I was struck by the reaction. The idea of the book seemed to strike a strongly favourable response, much more so than I've experienced with any of my previous books when I was asked that question and answered it. Naturally, I hope that the execution of the task has lived up to the potential of the idea. Retrieving these forgotten lives has been an exacting research challenge. I think they're strong stories, but I'm hopelessly biased, so what I think about that doesn't matter. What does matter to me is this. Now that these men and their stories have been retrieved, they should not be forgotten again. Thank you very much.